The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theworld.
Hi, Patrick here, and this song is from Norway. It's called Curing Norwegian Stiffness. It's comfort music for many Norwegians. So from comfort back to discomfort in Norway, and the words that the country and the rest of the world are using to describe the massacre that left at least 76 people dead. That's what we're going to be exploring today. There's the rhetoric that the killer Anders Breivik was exposed to, not just the neo-fascist garbage that he read online, but also the mainstream denunciations of multiculturalism. There's the toxic, surreal rhetoric of Glenn Beck, the way he described the massacre, and how that went down in Norway. And there's the debate over how we should describe the killer. Is he a lone madman? In other words, not quite part of our own civilized society? Or was he a product of that society? Also today, New York-based Ghanaian rapper Blitz the Ambassador. This podcast, The World in Words, and The Big Show, The World Radio Program, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, PRI, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. This podcast is at theworld.org/language. It's also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. There's also a Facebook page called The World in Words. So today, the language of the Norwegian bombing and shootings. We'll have quite a few takes on that, including the crime writer's perspective. Scandinavia, of course, is right now very much the capital of crime fiction. Also in the pod, hip-hop artist Blitz the Ambassador. When he moved from Ghana to New York, he didn't have to learn English. Most Ghanaians speak English. But he did have to, as he puts it, learn the lingo of rap. Okay, so for our first perspective on the Norwegian massacre and its aftermath, here is a conversation that the BBC's John Humphreys had with Matthew Goodwin and Lars Gula. Goodwin studies fascist groups at Nottingham University, and Gula does similar work at Oslo University College. First, here's Lars Gula on how societies with extremists within them, how they can move forward peacefully without a repetition of what we saw in Norway.
Part of the problem here and the challenge for Norwegian society, indeed all of European society, is now to discuss the environment, the discussion climate where extremist views are presented by a lot of people. When it comes to opinions, when it comes to statements, he was not alone. When it comes to acting, he was alone. How can we make sure that that border is maintained when you have a discourse where hatred is the norm?
You've had a sort of dialogue with him yourself, in one sense, over the internet.
Yes, I was on this particular website. I was the single opposing voice arguing against the xenophobic, Islamophobic postings and comments that were the norm on this page. And Breivik did not stand out with a particularly aggressive or violent rhetoric. He was quite mainstream. Of course, this was part of his idea to conceal his real intent, activities. Mm. But still, the ideas he shared with many.
And in fact, again, going back to that website that you became so familiar with yourself, Dr. Gula, Breivik actually posted the fact that there are ghettos in London, amongst other cities, where only Muslims can safely go, and people are the kind of no-go areas. I mean, he clearly believed all that stuff.
Yes, and this is he is not alone in believing this. This is standard beliefs among the xenophobes and Islamophobes on the internet, that the non-Muslim non-go zones exist in major cities all over Europe and indeed some parts of the States. So this is shows some of the warped sense of reality that is operating in this environment. And it's quite right. We are talking about a new kind of extremism, which clearly distances itself from Nazism, fascism, communism, and Islam and Islamism. They see all of these ideologies as threats. What they are claiming is to defend a conservative understanding of Christianity and European values.
And defend how? This is the question perhaps for you, Dr. Goodwin. We've seen what one madman can do, and clearly anybody who does what he did is definably mad. Have you got any sense of potential violence lurking out there?
Well, I spent about 4 or 5 years interviewing activists within the far right in Britain, the most committed supporters of this movement, and reading through Breivik's manifesto yesterday, I was struck just by the similarity in narratives across Breivik and some of these activists. The emphasis on a forthcoming clash of civilizations with Muslim communities, the need to take radical violent action, the observation that far-right parties aren't making progress enough. All of these were similarly evident in the interviews that I undertook, and I think that there is a narrative, there is a frame within the far-right that even if it doesn't endorse open violence, it contributes to a culture of violence that really permeates this movement.
What will they make, the people you've been talking to, what will they make of the things that Breivik has done?
Well, there's no doubt that, we've already seen evidence of sections of the far-right movement holding Breivik up as something of a hero and saying, you know, this was a guy who put the flag in the sand, who's essentially left a very detailed blueprint for anybody who wants to follow him. I mean, if you go through the manifesto, it's a detailed breakdown of what any would-be successor should do. But having said that, there are also large sections of the public, going back to the other speaker's point, who are very concerned over some of these same issues, the role of Islam in European society, immigration, multiculturalism. They might not endorse violence, but I think there is a pool of wider potential there for some of these ideas to take root.
And indeed, Dr. Gula, we've seen this in the rise of some far-right parties, not just in Norway, but in other Scandinavian countries.
Yes, and they all contribute to this debate climate, where it becomes legitimate to say the most outrageous things about other people, groups, Muslims, immigrants, and so on. And although the great majority of those who are promoting these ideas would never act upon them in the sense that Breivik has done, you have a climate where, in a sense, they have still contributed to legitimizing the violence. And this is the challenge, not only for the conservatives and reactionaries themselves, but for all society, I think. How should we confront this and at the same time maintain freedom of speech, which includes freedom for those who express disgusting ideas? This is really the challenge in the future.
Lars Gula, Matthew Goodwin, thank you both very much indeed.
Well, one of those ideas that Norwegians certainly found disgusting came just a few days after the massacre, and it came from the United States of America, from radio talk show host, former Fox TV host Glenn Beck. And it provided, I suppose, an immediate test of Norwegians' appetite for free speech. Just by way of background, the island of Utøya, where most of the killing took place, that was where the youth wing of the Norwegian Labour Party was holding its annual summer camp. So it was campers in the main part who were killed. The Big Show's Clark Boyd is in Oslo. Here's his report.
On Monday, Glenn Beck made this reference to the Utøya attacks on his syndicated radio show.
And then there was a shooting at a political camp, which sounds a little like, you know, the Hitler Youth or whatever.
That offhand comparison did not go down well here in Norway. Feelings are still very raw following last week's attacks. Anders Behring Breivik, who's admitted to the attacks, is an avowed right-wing extremist. And the Hitler Youth comparison especially hurts because Norway lived through Nazi occupation. One of the original leaders of the Norwegian Labour Party survived a concentration camp. But beyond that, most here are baffled as to how Utøya could possibly be equated with a Hitler Youth group. Martin Fredriksen is the former leader of Norway's Youth Labour Party and now runs the Utøya camp.
Utøya represents some of the finest qualities in a democracy, a place where youth can meet and celebrate values such as democracy and openness, quite the opposite of what the Nazis in Germany stood for. Other than that, I do not wish to give Glenn Beck any more attention.
Summer gatherings for youth parties in Norway have been a part of the political scene for 60-plus years, and it's not all work, says Labour Party politician Are Helseth.
It is a place where young people interested in politics discuss politics, get training in politics, but also have time for fun, for football, for other sports activities, and boys meet girls.
In fact, one walking path on Utøya is known as the Path of Love. But the fact is that many leading politicians in Norway today got their first taste of politics in these summer camps. Norway's current Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, for one. Martin Fredriksen fondly remembers one time when Stoltenberg visited Utøya.
I got to speak to the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, and be very critical of his policies. And he answered, as he always does, "This is a place of debate. It's very good to hear your opinions, and then we can disagree." It stands as a symbol both for me as a good memory, but also as a symbol of what Utøya was or is.
That correction speaks volumes. The Youth Labour Party is determined not to let the attacks or any comments cripple them. Members say they'll go back and rebuild Utøya and get it ready for next year. But it's not just one youth party that's been affected. Most of the youth parties in Norway have some sort of yearly summer gathering. The Young Liberals were set to have their camp this weekend. Their president, Sveinung Rotevatn, says it will go ahead with increased security.
The security part has been one of the most difficult issues this week when we were debating whether to cancel the camp or not. But we have been in touch a lot with the police, and they've told us that it's going to be safe and they're going to be there for us.
And what does Rotevatn make of Glenn Beck's comments?
These camps are such a nice and great and important part about Norwegian democracy that I don't really take that kind of comments all that seriously from someone who doesn't know what he's talking about.
For The World, this is Clark Boyd in Oslo.
The World in Words is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance by Parag Khanna, narrated by Jim Meskimen. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theworld. That's audiblepodcast.com/theworld.
Okay, here's a fairly typical take on Anders Breivik. This is from former Norwegian diplomat Jan Egeland. Egeland was actually supposed to be on the island on the day of the shootings to give a speech. His daughter was supposed to come along too. Some of her friends were among the dead, but there was last-minute change of plan and they didn't go. So what took place struck very, very close to home. The Big Show's Lisa Mullins asked Egeland for his interpretation of the shootings.
Does this event, in your view, Mr. Egeland, say something profound about Norway, or is this, do you believe, the case of a lone, deranged man who had a lot of firepower?
Well, I very much think it is the latter. Norway is still the society that you know and that I grew up in, where we have been privileged with very little social inequality. We have a very lively democracy. And this is the time to defend and promote human rights, not to limit them.
So Anders Breivik acted a lone madman, cut off in a way from Norwegian society. That's how his lawyer is framing it too. He's using the insanity defense. Most of the coverage frames it that way as well. He was a maniac. But is that the whole story? Does it automatically follow that if someone murders many, many entirely innocent people in cold blood, that he must be insane? I mean, if it does, why didn't we use that language to describe the terrorists who flew planes into the World Trade Center and killed many more people? Okay, another BBC mini round table now. The speakers here are Professor Andrew Silk, who advises the United Nations on terrorism and has written a book called The Psychology of Counterterrorism. Also, Majid Nawaz, who co-founded the think tank Quilliam, which studies Islamic extremism. And Nawaz himself was once an extremist. For 13 years, he was a member of an Islamic group called Hizbut Tahrir. He's denounced the group now. Here's the BBC's John Humphreys asking Nawaz about his state of mind back then.
So were you on the fringes of madness? I mean, how do we judge this sort of thing?
I think our double standard in this case serves only to undermine our efforts against Islamist extremism as well as far-right extremism. And I think we have to be consistent. So when we condemn Islamist extremists and hold them responsible for the violence that's perpetrated by some of them, not the majority of them, and we say that Islamist extremism must be challenged so that we don't get to a state where people are blowing themselves up, I think we must be consistent and say that far-right, racist, ultra-nationalist fascism must also be challenged so that we don't get to the state where they become terrorists. And I think, yes, this man was a terrorist. He was not just an isolated madman. We see from all the evidence...
But you could be both, presumably.
You could be both. Now, legally, if we say that he's a madman, then of course, he's not responsible
for his
actions.
If you're declared insane, you're not responsible for your actions, by definition.
It's dangerous. Now, we say it sensationally, we say it politically, but when we use the term madman in politics, what we mean is that it was an isolated incident. This clearly is not an isolated incident.
But when you looked at your colleagues in Hizbut Tahrir in the days when you were doing that sort of thing, you're not any longer. Obviously, you've left it a long time ago and you now condemn what they were doing. But when you looked at your colleagues, did you look at some of them and think, yeah, he's mad?
We now lead the challenge against all forms of extremism. And when I was with Hizbut Tahrir, when we looked at each other, we didn't think we were mad. We were actually genuinely motivated by political ideology, which is what I think this man Breivik is. He's motivated by a sense of political grievance. Now, what we need to do is two things, whether it's a society or government or both. We need to challenge that perception of grievance and address it where those grievances are real. And we need to undermine the narrative, the ideology that he subscribes to, which in this case is far-right fascism, and in Al-Qaeda's case is Islamism.
Mm. Andrew Silk, madness?
Well, it's a very common reaction to these type of events. I mean, I can certainly remember after many terrorist attacks, the press calling the perpetrators madmen, fanatics, psychopaths, whatever term you choose. But the reality in terms of when you talk to psychologists and psychiatrists who actually sit down and assess these people face to face, they're nearly always ordinary individuals. And I think that's one of the things that comes out of this.
Ordinary individuals who can go out and commit mass murder?
Absolutely. I mean, you just have to look at the Holocaust and some of the atrocities committed around the world over the past 100 years.
Isn't that rather different? If you're talking about an individual who is operating under a regime and obeying authority, we may now condemn them entirely, and we'll say, of course, they shouldn't have done it. But that is different, surely, from sitting in your house one evening, deciding to go out and kill 79 people. I mean, that is different, surely.
Well, I think with the spree killers, and again, in this case, whether I agree with the other speaker that it may be a mistake to view him as a spree killer. I think there's a clear political agenda going on here. There's a strong political motivation, but because he appears, and there's still a bit of uncertainty over this, to have been acting alone, then the psychological explanation, the idea that the reason he did this is because he's deviant, takes on more credence, takes on more momentum. But the reality, again, when these people are assessed face-to-face, it's relatively uncommon to find out this person is a psychopath, this person is a schizophrenic, there is something clearly wrong with this individual. And a lot of the time that isn't there. And I think even in the case of, if we look at suicide bombers as well, people often talk in a language of, oh, these people have been brainwashed, or these people have been, you know, they talk about a radicalization process and vulnerabilities and things like this. And that the reason they have done this extreme thing is because there's something very, very different and deviant about their psychology. And if you accept that interpretation, then it's a nice get-out clause of looking at what are the causes behind this, what are the issues,
which
what
is really the point
factors.
You were making.
It's the point I was making. When we think about the lady who stabbed Stephen Timms MP in East London, we didn't describe her in the press, at least, as a mad woman, or even the Christmas Day bomber. We said they are self-radicalised on the internet and connected up to a global network based with Awlaki in Yemen. And I think it's the same in this case. This man, through a global network, connected with anti-Islam fascists in America. He named some of them, and the EDL in Britain. And the mood music in Europe is changing, where minarets and headscarves are being banned. There's a wider fascist phenomenon on the rise, as its mirror opposite, Islamist extremism, is also on the rise. And the only solution is in civic debate to challenge both of them when they're non-violent, and legally to arrest and detain them
but
when they are violent.
But there is this huge jump, surely, between an extremist, which you were, a terrorist, which I'm assuming you were not.
No, I wasn't. No. Yeah.
And a maniac.
Yeah, yeah. There is a huge drum. And not every extremist, in fact, the majority of extremists and the majority of racists do not go on to commit violence. So we need to recognise that racism and Islamist extremism in and of itself is bad for society anyway, whether the majority go on to commit terrorism or not. And that's why they must be challenged in society. And it's our duty, in fact, to challenge racism as it is to challenge Islamist extremism.
I wonder sometimes, Mr. Silk, whether one sometimes avoids using the word mad for politically correct reasons.
No, generally I find it's the other way. I think people who use words like mad and maniac want to take a certain approach to the problem and basically say, look, we don't have to deal with this because it's a result of crazy people. So as a result, we don't need to make any political efforts. We don't need to look at the problem in any different way. We just need to catch these people and stick them away for a very, very long time. And I think if you basically say, well, what if they're not mad? What if they are relatively ordinary people and this is a result of processes which are not bizarre or the result of psychopathology, then you have to deal with the problem in a different way. And so I tend to find pretty much after every bad atrocity, you will find in some quarters people are trying to explain it in terms of this has been carried out by crazy psychopaths who are divorced from reality. They're not like you and me. And as a result, we don't need to treat them like you and me. We can do whatever we want in order to get rid of them.
Well, I'll have to end it there, I'm afraid. Andrew Silcombe, as you know, thank you both very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Here's one person who might have argued against the lone madman theory, the late Stieg Larsson, author, of course, of the best-selling novel The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and those other two companion novels. On the big show, we Skyped Nick Fraser. He edits the BBC's Storyville series of international documentaries, and he's also the author of The Voice of Modern Hatred, a book about the far right in Europe. Fraser says Larsson documented the Scandinavian extreme right, not just in his fiction, but in his non-fiction.
Stieg Larsson created a magazine called Expo, and it existed to document the activity of Scandinavian far-right groups. I think at the time he was criticized. People thought he was exaggerating the importance and the influence of these groups, who, after all, often consisted of very small numbers of people, or people who worked alone almost, like this killer, but who had fantasies of being very important and very connected to bigger things. But he persisted with his work, and he did very good work. And I think when he came to write his novels, he took some of the knowledge he'd acquired and he put it into the novels.
And how did he describe the extremism in the novels in a different way than he did in his nonfiction?
In the novels, he's more concerned with violence against women than political far-right violence. But he builds up this picture of repressed men who are fascinated by guns, who are fascinated by secret societies. And I think you can see the character type of this killer with his manifesto in a lot of the truly awful men that Larsson describes in his books. In a more general way, I think he saw the Scandinavian utopia as being fake. There was a sort of huge amount of talking about good feelings and about, you know, utopian visions of everyone behaving humanely and reasonably. But Stieg Larsson could see that this actually concealed really horrible behavior. And I think it's astounding to look at this atrocity in Norway and think, well, actually, you can sort of read his books much more literally than the 27 million people who've bought one or more of them will have actually read them. I mean, they may think of them as fantasies, but they have a core of political perception. They're not naive books. They're clever books about the contemporary world.
Does that mean that the stereotypes that we have of Scandinavia as being very safe, very measured, is necessarily upended? I mean, does that not exist anymore?
Well, I don't know about being upended, but you've got to remember that the Scandinavian utopia has always had its dark side. I mean, there are many, 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 many depressed writers about the kind of gloom of Scandinavia. So I think that every utopia has its dystopia. If you live in a messy society like Britain or the United States, if you don't nurse the idea that, you know, utopia is possible, then you probably find it easier to accept when things go wrong. But the Scandinavians do have an idea of the perfectibility of their societies, and they get tragically hurt when things go wrong, as they have in Norway.
Stieg Larsson faced personal consequences of writing about Europe's far right. Tell us what they were.
Well, he received numerous death threats. And I think he felt he lived in danger. And I think he was right to feel he lived in danger. I think these people are actually very dangerous indeed, as this episode reveals. And you have to take very, very seriously their threats, because actually these people don't go away. They may be small in terms of numbers, but you have to keep a watch on them.
Nick Fraser is the editor of the BBC's Storyville series of international documentaries. He's also a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's enough on that subject. To wrap things up in the pod today, let's talk to an ambassador. And a good ambassador needs to be skilled in communicating with diverse groups of people. It also helps to be multilingual and to be able to switch to the local language wherever you are. And that's as true for musical ambassadors as it is for the political ones. The Big Show's Alex Galifant has this profile of one such man.
He calls himself Blitz the Ambassador. He was born and raised in Ghana, in the capital Accra. But for 10 years, home has been the United States. And you can hear it when he talks.
I had to learn to speak like this, because if I'm going to be a rapper the same way that if I'm going to be a nautical scientist or whatever, I should learn the lingo and present myself as that.
That's being an immigrant. You take on some things, leave other things behind. You want to fit in, even as you hope to stand out. And it's not always comfortable.
Because when I return to Accra, guess what? I'm a stranger there as well.
Blitz the Ambassador knows that music is one way of making sense of it all. For his new album, Native Son, he says he built up the songs the way he himself is built, with Ghana and Accra the foundation.
Dear Africa, it's just me, your son. I pray this letter finds you better. Hope you're doing fine. I can't believe the 10 years have gone by since I last packed my bags, got a cab and said bye. Only imagine the feeling watching your kids go. Must have been heartbreaking. Where did the years go? But you'd be proud to know I never stopped repping you. Every track, every show, every last interview. Plus I hated how they painted your image in the news. All the stereotypical narratives describing you. If they ever met you, I bet you was undisputable. The way you shine, so black, so beautiful. From the depths of the Sahara, travel to Kilimanjaro, ancient mathematics, they forgot you're the land of the pharaohs. Plus you birthed us all, nobody can deny. Most of the men that said they loved you only robbed you blind.
Multiple languages, a wide-ranging geography, diverse musical styles. Blitz brought all those elements together by first singing the lines that make up the songs. He sang everything, the horn parts, the rhythms, and then his musicians translated that into instrumental parts.
I mean, if you listen to James Brown records, you can see he's just singing them the lines. Fela's the same. You can see he's just singing them the lines, and they resonate more. They're not abstract notes that were just written to live. They're things that were sung.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck D bringing the noise right here with my man Blitz the Ambassador right here, Native Son. That's right, check it out. It's not where you're from, it's where you're at.
Chuck D is Blitz's hero and mentor. He visited Ghana in the early 90s with Public Enemy, and Blitz soaked it all up. He says American music doesn't often produce that kind of politically engaged artist anymore. But Africa does.
Coming from where I'm from, I'm consistently engaging in debates about politics, about the IMF and World Bank. I mean, about these are real things to us. These aren't things that end up in the New York Times, you know. These are things that, conversations that are being had.
Dealing on the resource while they lie to us. From the World Bank loans to the IMF and the public politicians are supporting their policies, selling out their own people to the government overseas. So whatever they do, we do. Whatever they think, we think. It's so insane. How the riches got in there, it's got most of the poor people. They pillages. I wonder why we all not equal. Got a lot of nerve to be calling us third world, but we were the first architects of this world. Remember, ain't nobody saving no African. Only the African can save himself.
Ultimately, Blitz the Ambassador is a musician, not a politician. But he thinks about politics, just as he thinks about life in Accra and about his new life in Brooklyn. Native Son is his attempt to join the dots. As he puts it, to make the gaps smaller. For the World,
I'm Alex Galifant in New York.
Okay, that's it for this week. You can send me your feedback on Facebook, Twitter, or theworld.org/language. See you next week.